Welcome to today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger for Tuesday, April 23rd. I'm your reader, Marcy. Here's our first story from the Mason City Globe Gazette. Students test out potential career paths at STEM Festival. The North Iowa Area Community College Gymnasium offered its space to a younger generation Wednesday with the return of the North Iowa STEM Festival. With around 20 exhibits from local businesses and community partners, students from kindergarten to sixth grade were able to engage hands-on with different aspects of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics careers. Students were able to work with electric circuits, 3D printers, perform medical operations on teddy bears, and learn about outer space from exhibits hosted by organizations like Mercy One North Star, Stellar Industries, and a NASA ambassador. The festival was part of the Iowa Governor's STEM Advisory Council and many local partnerships like NIACC, Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, and the Mason City Chamber of Commerce. Mari Hodge, the North Central Region Manager for the STEM Council, said festivals are held throughout the state with the purpose of increasing excitement about engagement with careers in STEM at a young age and in a fun way. It's also for kids to realize that there are a lot more STEM careers than just being a doctor, scientist, or a computer programmer, Hodge said. STEM is really everywhere, and we've got a good representation of that right now. She said the festival predated her time on the STEM Council, but she saw a drop-off during the COVID-19 pandemic, and it's just returning to its former glory. About a year ago, I reached out to NIACC, because there was interest from parents in the community to bring it back. So it took us about a year to figure out who is partnering with us after getting the planning committee together again, and we're able to bring it back. Part of the event's mission, Hodge said, is to engage parents along with the kids to spur conversations around STEM after families leave the NIACC gymnasium. Parents really like the locality of the businesses that are exhibiting here because a lot of these parents say, "Hey, I work here," or "I do something similar to this," she said. One exhibit was from the Cerro Gordo Clean Energy District, which works to promote green energy in the county, and featured a mechanism on which kids were invited to crank a wheel to produce enough energy to power a light bulb. Kurt Nelson from the Cerro Gordo Clean Energy District said kids got to physically see how much more energy an incandescent bulb takes to power compared to a newer energy-efficient light bulb. All of these things are coming into play more and more, and it's great for kids to see because their future depends on a livable climate. In the exhibit, volunteers talked about their jobs, the impact of climate change, and what future careers in STEM might look like. Sarah Dickerson learned about the event from the school her son and daughter attend and came to Wednesday's festival hoping to expose her children to the fascinating world of STEM in a manner that's fun and engaging. Getting to see different things, getting to try different things, and being hands-on is really important, Dickerson said. It's been a pretty positive experience today. Apartment plan downtown sparking parking concerns. Mason City business owners are raising concerns that a proposal to develop apartments in a city-owned parking lot on the corner of North Delaware Avenue and First Street Northeast could cut into available parking downtown. Dev Partners is proposing a 36-unit, four-story apartment complex with an indoor first-floor parking lot at the site. The parking area will be leased by the city under the same rules for leased parking currently in place. No spaces will be reserved, even for tenants of the building. Each space will be leased on a first-come, first-served basis. The City Council discussed the plan during a public hearing last week. Diane Arndt, owner of Reflections Hair Salon, spoke to the council Tuesday night. "Ladies and gentlemen, we have a parking problem in Mason City," she stated. "We are horribly spoiled." Arndt told the Globe Gazette that in the 33 years she's been serving her customers, she's been blessed to have parking available. "I don't have negative feelings about the development. I just don't understand. I have some concerns about how this came to be and what we'll see going forward." Jessica Glenn, owner of Bear Sugar Salon and Med Spa, and Jen Pope, owner of Roots Nutrition, also raised concerns about parking for disabled and elderly people, as well as safety downtown. Their primary issue was that the business owners had questions that hadn't been addressed by city staff or council members. Businesses surrounding the proposed development include Brick Furniture, Reflections, Bear Sugar Salon and Med Spa, Three on the Tree Coffee, LeJames College, Fat Hill Brewing, Central Park Dentistry, Shelter Insurance, and Matt Dodge Agency, among others. The Federal Row Home apartment building development on 2nd Street Northeast and North Federal Avenue is an 11-unit building with no designated parking. Apartments exist in the upper levels of the number of downtown buildings without designated parking spots, including Central Park Dentistry and LeJames, respectively, and the city has been encouraging the development of the upper-story apartments by other property owners downtown. The city's goal is to always put the best use of resources like parking for the greatest benefit to businesses and residents of Mason City. Unused parking spots do not produce customers, residents, or taxes to support the infrastructure and services provided by the city, City Administrator Aaron Burnett said. Often vacant and limited-use parking lots are used for criminal activity and are costly to maintain. The activation of these areas produce a win-win for the community in creating more vibrant, safe spaces and adding population density to downtown. Parking is always needed to support the downtown, but it must be appropriately sized to the demands of the area. Burnett said during the meeting with the building's footprint will reduce the number of spaces the lot has by 9 spots. Arn understands that the street parking is available, but has concerns that the construction phase may block that parking. A 4-story building will require a crane, he told the Globe Gazette. That's already a small lot. Where are these construction vehicles going to be? Will the city let us know ahead of time that construction is starting? Burnett said in an email, the city has a vested interest in both progress and retaining established businesses. Downtown parking is a constant conversation for every community and will always be an important discussion for the city with its residents and businesses downtown, he said. As we continue to see the development of downtown, city officials and staff will always be open to changes to properly address this need with the resources available. Pope is willing to work with the city to grow both the downtown district and her own business. She echoed Glenn and Arndt in her concerns about safety and transparency. I try to do my part and have cameras and an alarm system, Pope said in her public comments. I see myself downtown for years to come. That's my dream. If I stay in this location, Mason City will continue to grow. I want to know that I can learn to stay in touch and how we can grow and learn together on some of these things. While I am sorry that anyone feels that we're not transparent, Burnett stated in an email to the Globe Gazette, I simply disagree with the statement that there is a lot of lack of transparency from the city staff and officials, and I would encourage individuals to reach out more with questions and direct engagement to find answers. I believe the city staff and officials have always been available to businesses and residents to communicate, and we work very closely with the Chamber of Commerce and the Main Street Mason City organizations. During band festival and other downtown events, the Mason City Transit System performs pickup and drop-off at the Delaware lot, Burnett said. There are plenty of large open spaces within the downtown the city can use to stage temporary transit operations should the transit station area not be accessible. Construction on the apartment is set to begin before summer. Don't marginalize immigrants who do difficult work. The deaths of 6 immigrant workers in the collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge on March 26 sparked the kind of collective empathy that usually follows tragic events. President Biden was among the many who offered his prayers, and news reports the men have been called kind-hearted, humble, and heroes. We should ask ourselves, is it only the tragedy that made them deserving of such labels? The disparaging way immigration is framed in the U.S. any other time makes this outpouring of praise seem like a trope. Routinely, we hear politicians, business owners, and analysts, even the well-meaning ones, say that immigrants do the job that Americans don't want, and for low wages. So we should be more open to embracing them as deserving of a place in our country. Let me break it to you. That's no badge of honor. To frame the conversation about immigrant workers around their sacrifices, a necessity for them, only marginalizes already vulnerable members of our communities. The topic of immigration remains a top issue. A recent Bloomberg News Morning Consult poll found that it ranks second only to the economy for voters. As we get closer to Election Day, we shouldn't be glorifying that immigrants do jobs that no one else wants to. Instead, we should talk more about the lack of safety of those jobs. The Baltimore tragedy underscored that construction is one of the deadliest industries in the U.S. as the focus turns toward rebuilding the bridge. It's been reported that Latinos, who make up 31% of construction workers, think the task is too dangerous. Other industries that rely on foreign-born workers are just as hazardous. The Department of Labor reports that employees of poultry and meat processing plants are exposed to diseases that are resistant to antibiotics and have had an increase of risk of developing lung cancer. The labor force behind this critical part of our food supply is made up of over 37% of immigrant workers, according to an analysis of federal data by the Economic Policy Institute. But we'd be remiss if we stopped there. U.S.-born workers are also toiling in poultry and meat processing plants, as well as building homes, repairing roofs, and refilling potholes on overnight shifts. Our focus should be on finding ways to make every job as safe as it can be for everyone. Documented and non-immigrants have, in the words of economist Steve Rattner, been essential to America's post-COVID labor market recovery. Those six men who died while working on the Francis Scott Key Bridge should be remembered as part of that essential recovery narrative. Outside of that, they had wives and children. They went to church on Sundays. They planted roots in the neighborhoods where they lived. At least two of them, Sandoval and Luna, volunteered at CASA, a nonprofit that serves and advocates for Latinos. The immigration status of all six men killed on the bridge collapse isn't clear, but the tragedy galvanized advocates, business leaders, and elected officials to band together and push for the Biden administration to extend temporary protected status to immigrant workers who have lived in the United States for 5 or more years, as was the case with at least 3 of those who died. It's a gamble, especially in an election year where immigration is a divisive top-of-the-mind issue. But for a group that's been helping rebuild this nation, it's a worthy wager. Obituaries for today, Tuesday, April 23rd. Marlon D. Ridson, October 30th, 1930 to March 25th, 2020. Marlon Ridson, Marley, 93, passed away peacefully surrounded by family on March 25th in Melbourne, Florida. He was born October 30th, 1930. On the family farm just north of Britt, to Milbourne Lloyd Ridson and Esther Tweeton Ridson. Marley grew up in Britt, Iowa, enjoyed playing sports and working for his father in carpentry. He graduated from Britt High School in 1948, having participated in football, basketball, baseball, and the school band. Marley spent 2 years at Britt Junior College before attending the University of Iowa, where his pride in all things in Hawkeye began. Between his first and second year at his time at Iowa, Marley served 3 years in the United States Air Force during the Korean War. He was attached to the 3510 Flight Training Wing, based at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas, rising to the rank of sergeant. He graduated from the University of Iowa in 1955 with a degree in math. After graduation, Marley worked in the personnel department at the State Street Sears in Chicago. In 1956, he moved to Elkhart, Indiana, to manage the catalog department for Elkhart Sears store downtown. In 1959, Marley became a sales manager for Monteith Brothers Incorporated in Elkhart. In 1963, he started his more than 35-year career in insurance and mortgage with the Chamberlain Agency, NIMCO, adding a real estate agency in 1984 and retiring in 1998. Marley met Laura Turner in 1961, and they were married in 1962 in Elkhart, Indiana, where they became very active members in the community. Marley spent more than 50 years as both a Mason, becoming a 32-degree Mason, and as a member of the Rotary Clubs in Elkhart and later Marco Island, Florida. He was a proud member of the Paul Harris Fellowship within the Rotary organization. He pursued his love of golf as a member of Elkhana Country Club, the Elks Country Club, Four Lakes, and Marco Island Country Club. Marley also enjoyed playing volleyball at the Elkhart Y, skiing at Swiss Valley, and fishing in the St. Joe and Gulf of Mexico. Marley and his family attended Grace Lutheran Church in Elkhart, later becoming members of the Zion Lutheran Church in Bristol. After retirement, Marley and Laura became members of the Marco Lutheran Church in Marco Island, where they also enjoyed singing in the choir. Over the years, Marley especially enjoyed his involvement in the Marco Lutheran Church Community Theater Project. His favorite performance was The Music Man, as it reminded him of his Iowa roots. Marley served his new home of Elkhart by serving on the Street and Highway Commission, the City Planning Commission, and City Redevelopment Commission, and was a member of the Chamber of Commerce. He was also a member of the Board of Realtors, serving a term as president. Some of the organizations closest to his heart were the Elkhart Community Foundation, the Wellfield Gardens, University of Iowa Writers Workshop, and the River Queen. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on March 30th at the Marco Island Cemetery in Marco Island, Florida. Memorial donations in lieu of flowers may be made to the Fund for Elkhart County at the Community Foundation of Elkhart County. Janet R. Thompson, December 1, 1940 to April 19, 2024. Janet R. Thompson, 83, of Rockwell, passed away Friday, April 19th at Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City. Mass at Christian Burial will be at 10:30 Thursday, April 25th at the Epiphany Parish, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, on 5th Street in Mason City, with Reverend Ben Valentine officiating. She will be laid to rest at Sacred Heart Catholic Cemetery, Rockwell, Iowa. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 Wednesday, April 24th, at the Hogan Bremer Moore Colonial Chapel, 126 3rd Street Northeast, Mason City. A rosary will be prayed beginning at 4:45, and a scriptural wake service will be at 7 p.m. Janet Rose was born December 1, 1940, the daughter of Raymond Conrad and Olive Marie Lammers Kepler. Growing up on the family dairy farm near Strawberry Point, Janet attended country school, later graduating from Strawberry Point High School in 1959. She moved to Des Moines, where she worked in records at the State Department, before moving to California for 2 years to work as an ophthalmologist technician. Following her mother's unexpected death, Janet returned home to help care for her younger siblings. She met Thorvald John Tommy Thompson, and on July 9, 1966, the couple was married at St. Joe's Catholic Church in Mason City by her uncle, Father Daniel Kepler. To this union, four children were born: Jody, Jackie, John, and Jason. The family made their home on a farm north of Rockwell, where they would raise their children. A woman of faith, hard work, and unwavering dedication, Janet's life revolved around her family and her farm, where she tended to her pristine lawn and flourishing garden with unmatched care. Janet ensured every important family gathering was accompanied with great food and all the sides. Grounded in her faith, she drew strength from her daily morning scripture readings, a practice that anchored her through life's trials. Janet's involvement in various community organizations included the VFW, Moose Lodge, Elks Lodge, and Eagles, alongside her husband, Tommy spoke volumes about their commitment to service. Yet amidst the hustle and bustle, Janet's greatest joy resided in the role of motherhood. Whether nurturing her own children or helping to raise and guide her siblings, she embodied positivity, kindness, and an unwavering belief in the bright side of life. Her warmth, compassion, and forgiving nature created a tapestry of love that enriched the lives of all who were fortunate enough to know her. Surviving her beloved husband of 58 years, Tommy, children, Jody Thompson of Hungary and formerly of Rockwell City, Iowa, Jackie David Weil of New Orleans, John Thompson of Rockwell, and Jason Thompsonville of Kirksville, Missouri. Grandchildren, Jacob Thompson, Hannah, and Ava Weil. Siblings, Charles, Chuck, Ruth Kepler, Mary, Tom Weber, Mark, and Betty Kepler, Dan and Nancy Kepler. Step-siblings, Mary Jane, Terry, Cole, and Betty Sands. Tommy's sister, Janice Hetland, sisters and brother-in-law, Bonnie, Diane, and Patty Kepler, as well as numerous nieces and nephews, extended family, and many cherished friends. Janet was preceded in death by her parents, Ray and Olive Kepler, and stepmother, Anita Cunningham, siblings Shirley, Bob Cisna, Robert Kepler, Thomas Kepler, Laverne, Jane Kepler, and Terry Kepler, stepbrother, Jim Cunningham. She was also preceded in death by Thorvald's parents, who cherished her dearly, Orville and Ruth Thompson, and brother-in-law Eugene Thompson. Susan A. Herubes. Susan Herubes, 72, of LaPorte City, Iowa, formerly of Britt, died Thursday, April 18th. A memorial mass will be held at 2 p.m. Friday, April 26th, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Bridge. In Britt. Motorcycle collision with deer sends rider to hospital Sunday. A motorcycle versus deer collision Saturday night sent a Mason City man to the hospital with injuries. Just before 11:30 p.m., April 21st, County Sheriff's Office responded to a motorcycle accident involving a collision with a deer near the intersection of 230th Street and Quail Avenue south of Mason City. Law enforcement said Dwayne Edward Kimna, 63, was driving a 2023 Zuma motorcycle east on 230th Street when a deer came out of the ditch. Kimna struck the deer, losing control of his motorcycle, and was ejected from the bike. Responding crews transported Kimna to Mercy One North Iowa Medical Center in Mason City to receive treatment for suspected minor injuries. The Mason City Police Department and the Mason City Fire Department assisted on the scene. Stop the Scammers event to be held Wednesday. The public is invited to join the Iowa Department of Insurance and Financial Services and AARP for a free educational Stop the Scammers event, according to a press release. The event will be held at 5 p.m. Wednesday, April 24th at the Mason City Public Library, located at 225 2nd Street Southeast. Reservations are required and a meal will be provided. Seats can be reserved by visiting iowafraudfighters.gov/stopthescammers-event. Con artists target people age 60 and older, swindling millions of Americans out of almost $28.3 billion, with a B, each year. The event is designed to help residents from becoming another statistic and protect themselves from fraud. The Stop the Scammers team of fraud fighters has compiled real-world tips and tools that can help protect individuals and their family, the release said. By arming yourself with knowledge of common fraud schemes, you can learn to avoid and report scams, the release said. Join Stop the Scammers in this seminar to become an Iowa fraud fighter and take steps towards a safer future. Supreme Court weighs outdoor sleeping bans. The Supreme Court wrestled with the major questions about the growing issue of homelessness Monday as it considered whether cities can ban people from sleeping outside when shelter space is lacking. The case is considered the most significant to come before the High Court in decades on the issue as record numbers of people are without permanent place to live in the United States. In California and other Western states, courts have ruled that it's unconstitutional to fine and arrest people sleeping in homeless encampments if shelter space is lacking. A cross-section of the Democratic and Republican officials contend that it makes it difficult for them to manage encampments, which can have dangerous and unsanitary living conditions. But hundreds of advocacy groups argue that allowing cities to punish people who need a place to sleep will criminalize homelessness. Biden announces $7 billion in federal solar grant. President Joe Biden marked Earth Day by announcing $7 billion in federal grants for residential solar projects, serving 900,000-plus households in low- and middle-income communities. He also plans to expand his New Deal-style American Climate Corps Green Jobs training program. The grants will be awarded by the Environmental Protection Agency, which unveiled the 60 recipients Monday. The projects are expected to eventually reduce emissions by the equivalent of 30 million metric tons of carbon dioxide and save households $350 million annually, according to senior administration officials. My MAGA Republican friends don't seem to think it's a crisis, Biden said Monday in Triangle, Virginia. Nursing homes. The federal government is for the first time requiring nursing homes to have a minimum staffing levels after the COVID-19 pandemic exposed grim realities in poorly staffed facilities for older and disabled Americans, Vice President Kamala Harris announced Monday. Voting machines. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday declined to consider a request by Republican U.S. Senator candidate Carrie Lake to ban the use of electronic vote counting machines in Arizona, marking the end of the road for an effort to require a hand count. Airline raises. Delta Airlines, the most profitable U.S. carrier, is raising pay for more than 80,000 non-union employees as it gets ready for another attempt by a union to represent its flight attendants, CEO Ed Bastian told employees Monday. Ghost guns. The Supreme Court agreed Monday to take up a Biden administration appeal over the regulation of difficult-to-trace ghost guns. It was struck down by a lower court, allowing the regulation to remain in effect while lawsuits continue. Trump bond. New York state lawyers and attorney for former President Donald Trump settled their differences Monday over a $175 million bond that Trump posted to block a large civil fraud judgment while he pursues appeals. You are listening to the Mason City Globe Gazette and Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm Marcy. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we'll turn to the Fort Dodge Messenger. Fort Dodge Council okays a $117 million budget. A roughly $117 million budget for the next fiscal year was unanimously approved by the Fort Dodge City Council on Monday. City Manager David Fierke gave the elected officials an overview of the spending plan during a workshop that preceded the council's business meeting Monday. There is no discussion by the council prior to the vote. The budget is for the fiscal year that will begin July 1st and end June 30th, 2025. The total spending is set at $117,623,294. That's down from the current year's spending of almost $161 million. The property tax rate in the new budget year will be $20.95 per $1,000 of taxable value. That is up about 20 cents from the current rate of $20.74 per $1,000 of taxable value. Fierke said that the increase is in the portion of the levy that pays for the city's property and liability insurance. That went up, he said, because of premium increases. Jeff Nemers, the city's finance director, said taxable value of homes in the city went down due to a state formula called the rollback, which determines how much of the property's assessed value is taxable. He said in the 2024-2025 fiscal year, 47% of a home's assessed value is taxable. Even though the rate went up, we're not raising taxes, he said. The budget also includes revenue from the water, sanitary, sewer, and storm water utilities, plus solid waste collection fees. Water rates went up 8% January 1st. Sanitary sewer rates went up 6% in the same time. Here are some of the major spending categories of the 2024-2025 budget. The water system, $8.2 million. Sanitary sewer systems, $6.7 million. Fort Dodge Fiber, $4.8 million. Police Department, $4 million. Fire Department, $3,586,498. Solid Waste Collection, $1,396,000. Ambulance Service, provided by the Fire Department, $1.1 million. Fort Dodge Library, $912,000. Road maintenance, $861,000. Regional airport, $773,000. Lakeside Municipal Golf Course, $636,000. Liability insurance, $605,988. Snow and ice removal, $513,000. Harlan and Hazel Rogers Sport Complex, $492,000. Aquatics, $411,000. Inspection Office, $289,911. Planning, $282,000. Blandon Memorial Art Museum, $270,000. Recreation, $238,000. City Clerk's Office, $213,000. Parks, $166,000. Mayor and Manager's Office, $153,000. And the City Council, $18,956. Man arrested for courtroom uproar. The father of a slain Fort Dodge man faces criminal charges for rushing towards his son's killer, setting off a short courtroom melee during an April 15th sentencing hearing. Edward E. Brown, 55, of 917 11th Street Southwest, was arrested by Webster County's sheriff's deputies and charged with first-degree harassment and disorderly conduct for his actions during the sentencing hearing for Quantarius Altman, 19 of Fort Dodge. The hearing resulted in Altman being sentenced to a maximum of 35 years in prison for killing Adrian Grover, 18, of Fort Dodge, on May 13, 2023, plus two crimes Altman was convicted of before Grover's death. Altman shot Grover in the chest with a handgun at about 2:45 a.m. May 13, 2023, in the 1000 block of 10th Avenue Southwest, according to court records. Iowa allows survivors of homicide victims to make victim impact statements during a sentencing hearing. Brown's outburst occurred during his victim impact statement. He walked to the witness stand at the front of the courtroom carrying a poster-sized photo of Grover wearing his graduation gown. He began a short, profanity-laced statement. Suddenly, Brown put the photo down, stood up, and began walking towards Altman. Friends and relatives of both Altman and Grover jumped to their feet and moved toward the front of the courtroom. Altman was hustled out of the room by a jailer, while other jailers, Webster County Sheriff's deputies, and Fort Dodge police officers moved in to separate everyone. In a criminal complaint filed against Brown, Sergeant Joshua Van Wace of the Webster County Sheriff's Department wrote, during the proceedings, the defendant told the victim multiple times he was going to kill him. Van Wace wrote that Brown proceeded to storm towards the victim in the courtroom. Brown made his initial appearance in Webster County Magistrate Court Monday. According to court records, he waived his right to a preliminary hearing on the charge of first-degree harassment. That means the case will proceed to an arraignment and trial. Magistrate Sarah Livingston issued a no-contact order, which directs Brown to have no contact with Altman or his family By violating the order, he would risk arrest again. Court action on the disorderly conduct charge was postponed for 180 days. In cases in which people face multiple charges, it is common to postpone action in the lesser ones until the serious charges are resolved. Fort Dodge woman faces drug charges. Drug charges have been filed against a Fort Dodge woman who is already in jail for an incident that injured two police officers and damaged a patrol vehicle. The new charges against Jonetta R. Clark, 40, of 1229 6th Avenue North, stem from the same April 17th incident. It occurred at 12:40 a.m. April 17th on the 1700 block of 5th Avenue South, when police attempted to stop Clark's Cadillac. She rammed a Fort Dodge Police Department vehicle with her vehicle during the traffic stop, according to criminal complaints filed against her. When officers attempted to remove her from the vehicle, she put it in reverse and began backing up. The criminal, at that moment, two officers were partially in her car. As a result, one suffered an ankle injury and the other suffered a shoulder injury. In the newest criminal complaints filed against her, police say she had more than 7 grams of methamphetamine, marijuana, a large amount of currency, and plastic bags with her that morning. As a result, she has been charged with controlled substance violation, failure to affix a drug stamp, possession of controlled substance, third or subsequent offense, possession of controlled substance, marijuana, first offense, and possession of a controlled substance, cannabis, first offense. These are in addition to previously filed charges of assault on persons in certain occupations, use or display of a weapon, 2 counts, second-degree criminal mischief, and interference with official acts. She made her appearance on the newest charges in Webster County Magistrate Court. A preliminary hearing was set for May 2nd. She remains in the Humboldt County Jail. Man arrested for holding a woman at gunpoint. A Fort Dodge man has been arrested for putting a gun to the head of a woman Sunday night. Matthew Crimmins, 42, of 201 21st Avenue South, was arrested by Fort Dodge police and charged with assault while displaying a dangerous weapon, first-degree harassment, person ineligible to carry dangerous weapons, and domestic abuse assault, display or use of a weapon. The incident happened 9 p.m. on Sunday in the 2400 block of 5th Avenue South. Crimmins placed a handgun against the woman's head and threatened to shoot her, according to criminal complaints filed against him. Police reported in those complaints that Crimmins had a blood alcohol content of 0.162. A blood alcohol content of 0.08 is considered legally intoxicated. Crimmins made his initial appearance in Webster County Magistrate Court Monday. A preliminary hearing was set for May 2nd. A no-contact order prohibiting him from having contact with a woman was also issued. Magistrate Court News, Webster County on Monday. Failure to appear. Christopher R. Hervey, Des Moines. Driving while barred. Wallace F. Brady, 55, of 702 30th Street, continued until April 29th. First degree harassment. Edward Brown, 55. Preliminary hearing waive, no contact order. Matthew J. Crimmins, 42, of 201 21st Avenue South. Preliminary hearing is set for May 2nd. No contact order issued. Assault while displaying dangerous weapons. Matthew Crimmins. And his hearing, preliminary hearing, is set for May 2nd. Person ineligible to carry dangerous weapons. Matthew Crimmins, 42. His preliminary hearing is set for May 2nd. Domestic abuse, display, or use of a weapon. Matthew J. Crimmins. His hearing is May 2nd. Controlled substance violation, Jonetta Clark, 40. Hearing is set for May 2nd. Failure to affix drug stamp, possession of controlled substance, or third or subsequent offense. And her hearing is set for May 2nd. Operating while under the influence, second offense, Elpido Garcia, 47, of 1807 2nd Avenue. Fifth-degree theft, Felix Lemieux Valavinos, 30 of Sioux City. he did not appear. There was an arrest warrant issued. And disorderly conduct, Edward E. Brown, 55. And that's been continued 180 days. Fort Dodge, on Sunday, an escape was reported at the 300 block of First Avenue South. Development deal with Nestle Purina approved. Nestle Purina Pet Care will get some financial assistance from Fort Dodge for an upcoming plant expansion under agreement approved by the City Council on Monday. The development agreement calls for the city government to give the company $1.6 million over 10 years. That money will come from tax increment financing, which occurs when the increased property tax revenue from a designated area is set aside to be reinvested in that area. The city's assistance is part of a broader aid package to support a project that will invest a minimum of $175 million in the plant at 2400 Fifth Avenue South. The project will create 50 net new jobs with starting wages ranging from $27 to $30 per hour. In February, the Iowa Economic Development Authority Board awarded the company tax benefits through the High Quality Jobs Program. Iowa Central Community College has agreed to provide job training to plant employees. The Webster County Board of Supervisors agreed to give the city $400,000 to be used as matching funds for a state grant. Local leaders hope to get to pay for the building, a turning lane on Fifth Avenue South in front of the plant. On Monday, the City Council hired Snyder & Associates of Ankeny to design that turning lane at a cost of $99,850. Obituaries. Pauline Fetlin from Goldfield. Pauline Conley Fetlin, 91, of Goldfield, passed away Saturday, April 20th, at Van Dyce Medical Center in Webster City, Iowa. Geraldine Dervage. Visitation will be held April 24, 2024, from 10 to 10:45 a.m., followed by a funeral service at Bowman Funeral Home. The Hot Corner, Tuesday, April 23, 2024. On this date nationally, 1939, Boston Red Sox Ted Williams hits his first major league home run. In 1946, Ed Head of the Brooklyn Dodgers pitches a no-hitter against the Boston Braves 5-0 at Ebbets Field. In 1950, the Minneapolis Lakers become the first team to win back-to-back NBA championships by defeating the Syracuse Nationals 110-95 in Game 6 of the finals. George Mikan leads the Lakers with 40 points in a game marred by three fights, four Minneapolis players fouling out, and Nats coach Al Servi being ejected for complaining too much about a call. In 1954, the NBA adopts the 24-second shot clock. 1954, Hank Aaron hits the first of his 755 career homers. 1969, Jerry West scores 53 points to lead the L.A. Lakers over the Boston. Over Boston, 120-118 in the opening game of the NBA Finals. In 1989, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar scores 10 points in his last game as a Laker in a 121-117 win over Seattle Supersonics at the LA Forum. In 1993, Orlando's Nick Anderson scores 50 points in the Magic's 119-116 win over the New Jersey Nets at the Meadowlands. Anderson's feat is overshadowed by Shaquille O'Neal, who rips down the backboard in the first quarter, delaying the game 45 minutes. St. Edmund Alumni and Friends Tourney. The St. Edmund Alumni and Friends Basketball Tournament will be held Saturday, May 4th, beginning at 8 a.m. Games will be a 10-minute halves at the high school gym. Entry fee is $25 per player. Each group must have at least five players signed up by April 28th, or other players will be added to their team. This tournament is not limited to alumni. For more information, please contact 515-570-7894. The Magwed Fishing Tourney is set for May 4th. The 48th Annual Magwed Fishing Tournament will be Saturday, May 4th at Triggs Bay Resort in Arnold's Park. The competition begins at 12:01 a.m. on Saturday, with weigh-ins from 4 to 6 p.m. that evening. Iowa DNR rules and regulations will be followed. There is no registration or fees. Prizes will be rewarded in youth and adult divisions for largest walleye, largest northern pike, largest bass, small or large, and biggest panfish for youth, perch, bluegill, crappie, sunfish, and yellow bass. Every youth fish weighed is eligible for a prize. The grand prize in the youth division is a bicycle. The event is sponsored by Magwed Foundation. For more information, please contact Jared Denklaw by email at magwed, that's M-A-G-W-E-D, at outlook.com. There's also a Facebook page. Windy Work. Volunteers tackle cleanup project in Fort Dodge. Neither gale force winds nor soggy footing prevented more than 40 volunteers from taking part in the annual FOD walk, sponsored by the Greater Fort Dodge Growth Alliance, on Monday afternoon. With winds topping 30 miles per hour and the ground somewhat mushy from recent rains, getting around and grabbing swirling garbage was that much more challenging for this year's participants. However, they managed to clean debris from fields around Target and Walmart along those behind KFC and running towards Baumgars. It sets the tone for our community, said Skylar Porter, marketing specialist for the Growth Alliance. It's great to clean up your community, and it also shows that being involved in your community is great. And cleaning up? What a better way to showcase your community than keeping it clean. Several businesses and organizations sent volunteer groups to help with this year's walk. They included Citizens, Community Credit Union, the City of Fort Dodge, CJ BioAmerica, First Interstate Bank, the Growth Alliance, Pride and Community Appearance, and Target. Individuals also volunteered representing Avalia Bank, Coke Fertilizing, Mid-American Energy, Starbucks, the Fort Dodge Police Department, the Fort Dodge Community School District, and Webster County. We had a good crew, I think over 40 volunteers. It's amazing how many people show to support our community, said Porter. This is awesome. Volunteers were given gloves and large garbage bags before heading out. They attacked the fields directly north of Target before heading to the other areas. We typically pick this area because it's a big focal point in our community, and there's typically a lot of trash in the fields. So we just like to keep it clean, said Porter. Sometimes we do this area and sometimes we do downtown. The tradition of the FOD walk was started by Rhonda Chambers, the director of aviation at the Fort Dodge Regional Airport, who once led the Alliance's image committee. She relied on her professional background to create it. FOD is an aviation acronym that stands for Foreign Objects and Debris. FOD walks are conducted at civilian and military airfields to remove anything from the runway that might damage a plane. In some cases, airfield personnel will stand shoulder to shoulder and walk down the runway looking for things. Chambers applied the same general strategy to the city. In its first few years, the FOD walk focused heavily on fields in the eastern side of the city, where shopping bags and other litter was known to accumulate. The walks were later expanded to include downtown. Heather Opendahl, a senior team leader at Target, was one of the volunteers for this year's walk. She said it was an easy decision to take part in the effort to clean up the fields. Target is always about community and making things better and brighter, she said. It's always good to give back. The turnout is amazing. It's good to see this many people taking part. It was the 18th year for this walk. The 2020 walk wasn't held due to the pandemic. And finally, Podolak stepping away from Live Mike. Longtime Iowa football broadcaster Ed Podolak announced Monday that he'll move out of the radio booth this season and limit his appearances to pregame shows and podcasts. Podolak played quarterback and running back for the Hawkeyes, before he became a fixture at running back for the Chiefs from 1969 to 1977. He was a color commentator for NBC and ESPN before he joined the Iowa radio team in 1982. He worked nearly 500 games alongside play-by-play men Jim Zobel and Gary Dolphin. I have said it often across 27 years that Ed Podolak is the best I've ever worked with in the broadcast booth, Dolphin said. One of the game's great competitors, Ed's ability to explain plays was unparalleled. Football mentality of all ages understood and enjoyed the humor each Saturday. I look forward to Eddie's continued involvement on game day. Podolak, age 76, said in a statement that he decided the time was right to step back from some of his broadcasting duties. I believe there is no greater honor than to be part of the Iowa Hawkeyes football team. I have loved watching these young men and coaches compete for the past 42 years. Sharing my perspective for the incredible Hawkeye fans from coast to coast has been a thrill. Podolak was named first team All-Big Ten and team MVP in 1968 when he set a then-conference record with 286 yards on 17 rushing attempts against Northwestern. He had nearly 4,500 yards rushing and 2,500 yards receiving and a combined 40 touchdowns in 104 games for the Chiefs. He is a member of the Chiefs Hall of Honor. Here's a little hint from Heloise. Use these two steps to avoid fraud. Dear Heloise, in response to recent hints regarding credit card protection, I have my 2 cents to add. We have recently had our major credit card canceled and was replaced 3 times in 3 months. This is such an inconvenience. I asked the credit card company what we could do to prevent future problems related to fraud. The fraud seemed to be coming from in-person purchases, so they suggested 2 things. Always tap the card on the credit card machines instead of inserting or sliding the card in, if available. Cover your account number on the front of your card with a piece of tape, like blue painter's tape or masking tape, that can be easily removed, if needed. The reasoning behind this is to prevent anyone near you from snapping a photo of your card during the process of a transaction. There are cameras everywhere, as well as unscrupulous people. Since we've started tapping the card during purchases and keeping the account number covered, we have not had any fraud problems for the last few months. Hope this helps someone else. Becky, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Here's a hint for watering plants. Dear readers, when you water plants, soak the soil thoroughly when watering. A sprinkling of water can cause roots to come to the surface and get baked to death by the sun. The idea is to get the roots to go down deep where they won't be subjected to summer heat. It's the best way to water plants early in the morning so that the leaves will dry in the sun. When the leaves stay wet all night after an evening watering, spot diseases may occur. Here's a trick to opening jars. Dear Heloise, I'm an 88-year-old man and I have trouble opening jars, but I have found a paint can opener that works great. I just place the opener in the indented area of the lid and gently press down. The seal easily gets broken. Digitizing photos. Dear Heloise, I read your hint about having old photos digitized. There's an app called PhotoMine, which works wonderfully and allows you to digitize your photos for free, minus the nominal cost of the app. Also, if any of your readers are Amazon Prime members, they may have an unlimited storage space for photos. Other apps to do as well. Best regards. Here's an aluminum foil idea. Dear Heloise, years ago, a good friend of mine told me about a great aluminum foil idea. Whenever using crock pot or a roaster, place foil, tin foil, between the lid and the pot. It will not evaporate. Just be careful when removing the foil. The steam is hot. That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette and the Fort Dodge Messenger. I'm Marcy. Thank you for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thank you.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay!
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.